X-Ray.fm, where radio is yours.
The views and opinions expressed during the X-Ray AM morning show belong to us, the hosts, and do not represent the official policies or positions of X-Ray FM.
Any content provided by the DJs and commentators are not intended to offend any specific demographic, including religious groups, ethnic and cultural identities, club, organization, company, or individuals.
Good morning to y'all.
And welcome back to the Commons, your Monday morning radio guide to news, culture, and local action.
Start your week informed with stories that matter to you and your neighbors, spotlighting people and events shaping Portland's future, environmentally, socially, and economically.
With a focus on direct action, union organizing, and the thriving local art scene, we are here to help you play the cards in your hand and make a difference.
Whether you're tuning in for the news, the music, or the opportunity to act,
The Commons is where Portland gathers. And we're your hosts. I'm Hannah Francis.
And I'm Julia Moore.
And it is 8 a.m. on Monday, August 25th. Stay tuned. We got an interesting show coming up. We just heard an interview with Grace Mongali from Street Roots. And before that, the Listeners Podcast. Up next, we've got some news from the Commons. And then later on, we've got a segment from Heartsbeat, as well as some upcoming music here in town.
That's right. And if you all want to text into the station and potentially have your text read on air, you can text in at 971-220-5979.
Yeah.
Are we still in some extreme heat?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, not as bad, I don't think, right? Because, like, the last 2 days... we're like 102 or something.
Yeah, I think we're getting the cloud cover that's kind of capping the heat inside of it. Mm-hmm. So we're looking at partly cloudy today and tomorrow with a high of 92 degrees and a low of 66 degrees.
Oof, yikes. Yeah. So I'm continuing to drink water and to water my plants. Highly recommend.
Yeah, there's no rain on the forecast right now. So... yikes. A splash your face, I guess.
Yeah, it's going to stay in the 80s throughout the entire week, huh?
Yep.
Wow.
That's pretty brutal.
Yeah, it's going to be rough. I don't know if y'all are feeling it, but I'm feeling it. I'm feeling fried.
Yeah.
Like an egg.
Fully baked.
I'm hungry, though.
Unrelated, but very important.
Well, you know, I was thinking about eggs.
Oh,
yeah.
You're like, ooh, I want a fried egg. Actually.
Yeah. Sounds pretty good.
I don't think I've ever had a baked egg.
Oh, I have.
You put it in the oven?
Mm-hmm. Like shakshuka.
Okay. I definitely make shakshuka on the stovetop, so maybe I'm doing it wrong.
Well, you can, like, make it on the pan and stick it in the oven for a minute. Also, frittata's baked, so technically. Also, quiche.
Okay. You know? Okay. Quiche.
Yeah.
I've had a baked egg, folks. All right.
Hope you're eating well out there. Text us in your favorite breakfast.
That would be cool.
If you'd like. That's the option. Our text line is 971-220-5979. Gotta take the little joys where we can.
Exactly.
We got a lot of news for y'all. Lots of big things happening in the world. Last week on Thursday, the district court judge Kathleen Williams issued a ruling that President Trump's Alligator Alcatraz Migrant Detention Center must be dismantled and that no more migrants can be taken there. So this was an 82-page ruling. It was a lot of information that stated that the facility was causing a huge amount of environmental damage to the Florida Everglades and that the Trump administration has 60 days to wind down all operations. The judge used a preliminary injunction, which imposes temporary restrictions on operations at the facility. And those restrictions don't allow any more people to be taken there. And Florida has partnered with the Trump administration to file an appeal against the injunction. But Thursday's ruling dealt a major legal blow to Trump's plan for the center, which has faced widespread criticism for its harsh conditions and irreparable harm to the Everglades. Judge Williams also ordered the shutdown of, quote, all generators, gas, sewage, and other waste receptors, which will significantly impact the center's ability to operate. In her ruling, Williams also referenced a plan that was struck down to build a tourist airport in the Everglades in the 60s, saying that every governor since then has been aware of the importance of the environmental protection of the Everglades. So this was a huge win for environmental groups and against what has been a centerpiece of Trump's immigration crackdown. Experts had previously warned the Trump administration about the potential harms to the Everglades, but obviously these were completely ignored. The detention center had been built in 8 days, and now five other Republican-led states are in the talks with the Trump administration about how they might replicate this model and build their own detention centers. So not sure if a lesson has been learned. Actually, I can say with confidence a lesson has not been learned, but it is some small win for the environment and
the environment folks are pretty good at figuring out like which specific regulations are going to protect mm-hmm. us, which is fantastic. I think the lawyers who study the information and have really stepped it up mm-hmm. here are doing that in so many different places.
Yeah, I do think it's interesting that like environmental protection laws are easier to navigate than human rights laws. You know, it's fascinating, really. You know, like the parameters of what is okay to put a human through is harder to define than what is okay for the environment, apparently. Which, you know, I love the environment. I want it to be okay, but...
Yeah, this is actually a topic that's pretty in-depth explored in the book Abundance by Ezra mm-hmm. Klein and Derek Thompson. If you guys want any further reading on why that is.
That sounds really good. What's it about?
It's about how much potential there is in our policies to protect humans and the earth. Mm-hmm. But the history of environmental protections and in a sense, like there's almost, there's this like spectrum of from bureaucracy to really functional environmental protection. So they all fall into the same boat where there's an environmental protection of the kind of stove you can have in your mm-hmm. house, but the kind that is cheaper is more accessible to mm-hmm. a lot of people. So then they're like, oh, well, I'll be able to afford to build my home because I can afford these cheaper forms of appliances. Mm-hmm. But then it results in like more low income people all being grouped together in the same neighborhoods, et cetera. And that's the same environmental protections that are policies that are stopping alligator Alcatraz from continuing on. And so it's Abundance is, this is like just a very small part of it, but it's really a book about the potential for the future and how there actually is, like, it's not all over, folks. There are opportunities for things to get better, and we have the infrastructure and the policies for it. It's about how do we use those to do things like shutting down alligator Alcatraz.
Sounds like I might need to read that.
It's really good.
Jeez. Sounds great. Because there's a lot of bad news in the world, including that last week, the United Nations-backed panel declared the famine is that Gaza is in famine. And I feel like this has taken a really long time for them to actually get to that that point of that label. And I think a lot of people are really confused as to why this just happened last week. But I wanted to give a little background context to what the famine qualifier is. And first of all, the IPC has confirmed that 500,000 people in Palestine and in Gaza are on the brink of starvation. 500,000 people. And Israeli restrictions on the number of food trucks entering Gaza has continued to limit the flow of food and aid to the hungry people there. And these conditions have to be met before a place is technically in famine. So it's famine is a five-phase scale, and phase one is conditions are normal. Phase two, communities are stressed but still eating enough, but are, you know, struggling to afford essentials. Phase three, hunger conditions become nervous, and people have a difficult time getting enough food across the board. Phase four, emergency hardships deepen. Food gaps widen as people often resort to liquidating assets or eating seeds needed for future planting. And phase five is where a specific location is in famine, which must meet three conditions, which is at least 20% of households face catastrophe, meaning an extreme lack of food that leads to acute malnutrition and mortality. Second, at least 30% of children under five suffer from acute malnutrition or wasting. 30% of children under five. So atrocious. At least 2 of every 10,000 adults die each day from non-trauma-related causes. So hunger often kills not just through starvation, but also through weakened immune systems to the point where people can't fight off diseases. So these three conditions have to be met in order for a place to technically be in famine, which are incredibly extreme qualifiers. And they also say that like tons of starvation happens before the famine level is qualified, which we've been seeing happen in Gaza. And if, like I just said, IPC found that Gaza City and the surrounding areas are in phase five famine. And a representative from IPC said, it's not too late to take action in Gaza, but time is running out. The goal of the famine classification system is to alert the world before it's too late. He also said that a famine declaration carries a lot of weight, and this should increase pressure on governments and agencies to ramp up aid. And it puts more pressure on Israel to allow full humanitarian access to Gaza. So hopefully this qualification will put a lot of pressure on, you know, people all around the world to let some aid in there. But it is really horrifying to see this.
Yeah. It's pretty staggering how much aid is actually just sitting on the border. Like, there is enough food just sitting right outside Palestine to feed everyone. It's just not being allowed in by Israel, which points to the fact that this is a manufactured famine.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which is a war crime.
Yeah.
Yep.
One among many,
yeah. Bringing it to Oregon. Oregon lawmakers will hold a special session August 29th to address a funding crisis at the state's transportation agency. Governor Tina Kotek is pushing for a 6-cent gas tax hike, higher registration and title fees, and a doubling of the payroll tax for transit agencies to prevent what ODOT warns could be the largest layoff in state history. State Representative Shelley Beauchart Davis, a key Republican on transportation, is questioning ODOT's approach, saying the agency is acting more like an advocate than a neutral provider of information and urging lawmakers to consider changing laws that restrict how ODOT spends its money instead of just raising taxes. Democrats, who hold supermajorities in the legislature, are expected to advance the funding package. A public hearing on the bill is set for Monday, August 25th at 3 p.m. That's today at the Capitol. This is pretty significant. I don't know if y'all heard what the what will be taxed, but that would be 6 cent gas tax hike, higher registration and title fees. That falls onto us. Those are higher fees when we go to the DMV. So I do think there's a lot that goes into this that would take some significant research and time for each of us to really delve into. But looking at this, it might be important to know what is happening here. And I'll be really interested to hear the testimony from today from the Capitol.
Absolutely. I also think it's worth mentioning that, like, I would not necessarily be opposed to this if, you know, maybe, like, public transportation were now free.
Yeah.
You know, because people do need a way to get around, and public transportation should be funded, and it should be accessible. And, you know, cars are not great for the environment, and, like, it is a kind of thing where, like, a lot of people who can't afford a car take public transportation, and the more people that can afford cars will take public transportation. Which, like, I'm not saying that's the solution. I don't know what the solution is there, but I'm just saying, just making everything more expensive doesn't really work for me.
Yeah.
I don't know what if, like, buses are a part of this bill, but I'm curious to see what role public transportation is playing in it.
I don't know about buses, but they did say there is no mention of like repair on roads and things, like upkeep. There was no mention of that in this bill. So, like, if there's a pothole, it's gonna keep being a pothole, sounds like.
Yeah, I feel like that's kind of the way things have been for a while.
Yeah,
there's a vigilante pothole filling group, actually. I don't have the information on them, so I'm not going to say any wrong information on the radio, but they seem really cool.
That's pretty sick.
Yeah.
Shout out to that.
Apparently, they go fill potholes in the middle of the night.
Damn.
More cool things that are happening in Portland. Tomorrow, on Tuesday, August 26th, local Filipino solidarity organizations will continue to hold community events, and they're going to hold this community teach-in at Peninsula Park. So People Organizing for Philippine Solidarity, otherwise known as POPS, is a grassroots organization which is a part of Friends of Filipino People in Struggle, also known as FFPS. And these groups are part of a growing network of solidarity for people in the Philippines, Filipino immigrants, and immigrant workers across the board. The teach-in will commemorate the Cry of Pugadlawan, which is the historic uprising that marked the beginning of the Filipino people's struggle against Spanish colonial rule in 1896. And today, the Philippines are still under colonial rule. It's just neo-colonial rule of the United States. The Filipino president, Marcos Jr., is backed by the United States. And the Filipino people, pinned between the increasingly widespread anti-immigration laws enforced in America and Marcos' de facto martial law throughout the countryside of the Philippines, folks are trying to make their voices heard, and I think pretty successfully. I think that they've been doing an incredible amount of community organizing that is really supporting all migrant workers as well. The teach-in will be about the history of forced Filipino migration, their struggle under Trump's anti-immigration policies, and specifically, you know, like, not just anti-immigration, but specifically anti-immigrant policies, and the broader movement of migrant worker liberation nationally and globally. And that event is going to be on Tuesday, tomorrow, August 26th at Peninsula Park.
The Philippines are incredibly organized and have been pretty successful in their endeavors. So I don't have any doubt about this being a pretty significant teach-in. It's pretty exciting. All right. There is an ongoing strike for Gaza. According to Humanity Project, every Thursday from August 21st, last week and on, will be a global boycott for Gaza. This means allies and global organizations will cease their spending on Thursdays to show those in power the number of people that are ready to stand behind what they believe, you know? So if you
want to demonstrate for Palestinians.
Yeah, like, that you believe that what's happening in Palestine.
Yeah, like this will hopefully show people through like direct marks in
the economy.
In the economy.
Yeah.
That's the goal there.
That we don't support genocide.
Yeah. So that started last Thursday and it's going to be every Thursday from now on. I know that some businesses are trying to change the days that they buy things because those things are like more impactful because they're on a large scale.
Yeah.
I know a lot of people are doing their shopping on different days, and even buying tickets for transportation on different days and just making sure that like every penny that they spend is not on Thursday, just to make as much of a mark as they can. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah. All right. So Portland is a sanctuary city and it has been under some stressors because of the Trump administration. However, late last Friday, a federal judge blocked the Trump administration from cutting off funding to more than 30 cities and counties, including Boston, Chicago, Denver, Los Angeles, and Portland, over their sanctuary policies. U.S. District Judge William Orrick in San Francisco extended an injunction preventing the administration from withholding federal money from jurisdictions that limit cooperation with immigration enforcement. Orrick called the administration's actions an unconstitutional coercive threat and also barred immigration-related conditions on certain federal grants. The ruling is the latest setback to President Trump's efforts to punish sanctuary communities as part of his broader immigration agenda. The administration has, of course, appealed the decision. Just east of Portland is the Klickitat Valley in the Columbia River Gorge. And Klickitat Valley Health is bracing for federal Medicaid cuts, but says it has strategies to soften the blow. At a July 23rd board meeting, CEO Jonathan Hatfield said the hospital will face revenue losses from upcoming federal changes, but plans to help patients stay enrolled in Medicaid, build reserve funds from an unexpected $1 million federal payment, and benefit from future local tax revenue tied to new infrastructure projects. Hatfield acknowledged challenges ahead, including shorter enrollment windows and uncertainty over how a new $50 billion federal rural health fund will be distributed. But, he says, Klickitat Valley Health remains stable and is one of just 8 hospitals nationwide chosen for a program to boost rural hospital revenues, calling that a huge win. Yeah, so Klickitat Valley is just east of Portland in the Columbia River Gorge and will not be the only hospital impacted by cuts to Medicaid in the years coming up. So this is a good thing to keep your eyes on and see how hospitals and different medical institutions are handling the cuts to federal funding. And on a final note, y'all, it is recess for the city council. So this week, there will be no committee meetings and there will be no city council meetings. The next city council meeting is September 3rd at 9:30 a.m. Each of the councilors have a newsletter where you can stay up to date with what they are working on and advocating for in city council. So if you'd like, with this week off from the committee meetings and the city council meetings, might not be a bad idea to get a little caught up on what they're up to individually.
Thanks, Julia.
Mm-hmm.
Up next, we've got use it or lose it, question mark?
We do have use it or lose it.
Amazing.
Yeah. So from the Commons and X-Ray FM, this is Democracy, Use It or Lose It, the Common Civics Quiz. So here on the Commons, we talk about local, state, national, and international news. Wow. So how to stay up to date on that and have an idea of where you might want to get involved. Well, you can do that here on Use It or Lose It. So let's get our quiz questions going. We have one question that we're pulling over from last week because it is still relevant this week. So, number one, reporter Bissan in Gaza has called for urgent global action. What event is being planned in response? A, a fundraising gala in Portland. B, a global strike on Thursdays. C, a town hall with U.S. senators. Or D, a film screening on September 16th. All right, a bing, 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 ding. Later, you can, reminder, you can text in at 971-220-5979. The answer for that is B. The answer to that is B.
The answer to that is B, which is cool. And also, thank you to the person who just texted in a word that I can't say on the radio. They said F ice and their orange face leader.
Amen.
I think that's P-Town, like a heart P-Town.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, we love
thank
P-Town.
You. I appreciate that comment.
Yeah.
Oh good. It's from a burner phone too.
Cool. All right.
Thanks for texting in that.
Yeah, we love it.
Mm-hmm.
All right, next question. What is happening at Peninsula Park on August 26th? That's tomorrow, folks. A, a rally for higher wages. B, a Filipino community teach-in on colonial history and migrant struggles. C, a city council candidate forum. D, a celebration of Portland's founding. All right, and bing, bing, ding. The answer is B. It's a Filipino community teach-in. This is a great opportunity to learn some strategies for liberation. All right. And question three. What will Oregon lawmakers discuss at the August 29th special session? A, legalizing marijuana statewide. B, increasing funding for public schools. C, raising taxes and fees to prevent ODOT layoffs. And D, cutting taxes to stimulate the economy. All right. And if you were listening a little bit earlier, you would know that it is C, raising taxes and fees to prevent ODOT layoffs. Ah. If only that was a tax for the rich. All right. And question four. When is Portland City Council's next meeting following its current recess? A, August 25th at 3 p.m. B, September 3rd at 9:30 a.m. C, September 5th at noon. D, August 30th at 10 a.m. That was a speed round, folks. I read that super fast. That's a lot of dates, but
I just want to say that I would guess that the answer is B because that's my mom's birthday, so it's obviously
happy birthday,
the best
Mom.
Day.
It's the best day for a city council meeting.
Yeah,
that would be wild to bring your mom's birthday to the city council meeting. Like everyone's just like passing out cupcakes.
Yeah, it's gonna be a great day.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right, yeah, and that is correct. September 3rd at 9:30 a.m.,
see?
Hannah's mom's birthday is the next city council meeting. There's also a city council meeting in the morning on Wednesday the 3rd, and then on Thursday in the evening. So if you can't make it in the morning, which most of us can't, then you can come in third on the Thursday in the evening. All right, and the final question. What did the UN-backed panel declare about northern Gaza last week? A, conditions are improving. B, it has entered phase 5 famine. C, there's no risk of hunger. D, food aid has fully met needs.
I mean, yeah.
Yeah, bing, 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 ding. The answer is B, has entered phase 5 famine, which is near extinction levels of death. So you can call your senators and representatives, and it's boycott time. So let's go. Thank you for joining us for Democracy, Use It or Lose It. Remember, if our democracy fails, it's because, in part, we let it go. You can hold on today by joining us with Use It or Lose It on X-Ray FM.
Thanks, Julia. We're going to go off to our segment from Portland Community College, Heartsbeat, and then we'll be back for a little bit more news and some music, and then we'll turn you off to... hand you off to Tom Hartman.
That's right.
We'll be right back.
Yeah, we're never gonna turn y'all off.
Thanks. To this interview. So tell us a little bit about your jobs and what does a faculty curator do?
I'm Christine Weber. I'm the curator of the Northview Gallery. We start by meeting with, well, actually by sending out a call for artists. So that's kind of the first step towards getting local artists, regional artists to propose shows for the gallery. Then we convene our exhibition advisory board, who with us reviews all the proposals, and we spend a lot of time talking about what's going to work well with our curriculum, relate to and engage with as many programs as possible on our campuses, and really be valuable as teaching tools within our academic setting. Once we decide on the exhibitions that we're going to mount that year, then the really fun and enjoyable work starts.
And then with like a lot of the sort of back end things, you have dealing with the press release and how you want the artist's voice to come out to the public in order to bring people into the show. I'm Zainab Saab, and I am the gallery director at the Cascade campus. And you also have kind of what Christine said too, with bringing students, you also have students that work in the gallery and training them and teaching them like how to install a show, how to deinstall a show, and just how to be a gallery attendant.
Yeah, the level of professional development that students who work with us get is pretty phenomenal.
And it's like a benefit for them too, like get to know their community.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really exciting part where people come up to them and they're like, who's this artist? What's this show about?
It helps the students not feel so intimidated about walking into galleries.
Right.
I'm Petra Sirenen, and I'm the curator at the Helzer Gallery at PCC Rock Creek.
So how do students usually experience the galleries, and what role do they play in campus life?
We do a lot of workshops with our artists, so I ask each artist if they want to do a workshop with the students, and so then I would pair them up on a day that, say, printmaking is meeting, and they'll come and give their artist talk on that day and then do a workshop with that group of students, plus outside of students who want to participate in that. So they get real one-on-one time with the artists and get to know them better that way. Mm-hmm. The artist talks are always a big draw. We get a lot of people coming in. It's usually pretty crowded.
Yeah.
We sit on the floor.
The workshops always tend to be so exciting because students are actually getting to make work with the artists. There's something about that kind of like real time.
It breaks the wall for me. Like, I think that's what it is, where it's like you get to see the artist working versus the artist talking really formally about their practice. And there's like a level of like intimidation I'm sure students feel, whereas like in real time, show you their process, and that way it kind of turns like from for the student from, oh, this is an artist, but they're also an instructor too. So then it kind of welcomes them in a little bit because of that familiarity of like, oh, you're teaching me something.
Anna Fiddler came in, and her work is kind of spiritually based and very intuitive. And she has this practice of making little postcard-sized pieces that are just really begin with a couple words or thoughts that are in her head and then become a very intuitive painting process. So she did those cards with our students in painting. And it was really interesting to see what came out of that. And they sat quietly for 3 hours doing these intense little drawings. And then everyone displayed them and kind of talked about them. We also had a workshop with Andrew Myers, who does work exploring kind of wolves and the territoriality of wolves. And he did a printmaking workshop with our students where he had this kind of collaged giant piece in the gallery, and the students added to it. They made prints, and then he collaged them into the show as the show was going on.
There was that show that really... Muna Hanedi show with the kites,
yeah,
and the power of that show, and doing the kite workshop, that was a really beautiful experience.
The kite workshop was wonderful, and we were able to display the kites made by ESOL students for the rest of the year, and so they had their work on view in the building that they had made, you know, with Mona.
Yeah,
that was a really beautiful show, and that was probably one of my favorite workshops from this year. The workshop was drawn from an exhibition. An artist, Nimon Hunedi, who's a Palestinian-American artist and wanted to respond to the violence happening in Gaza, and created a gallery full of kites, an installation essentially filling the gallery with kites, including video projection and sound that she drew from archival footage from reporters. Her interest was in part in honoring all of the reporters who have lost their lives attempting to communicate to the world about the violence, and wanted to engage students around the object of a kite. And it was really beautiful, both her and Hamid Nabil, who was an expert on the design of kites specifically from Gaza, talked about their experience flying kites as children and how meaningful the kite was. And then a lot of the students, because it was a really global group from ESOL, were talking about their own experiences flying kites, and those kites have remained up in the building, and it's lovely to have kind of a evidence of the workshop and evidence of students' creativity and engagement with the artists that that we're able to see in the building long after the exhibition is gone.
So tell us about the student art show. How does this show enhance the experience of art students at the college?
So the student art exhibition is taking place in all three galleries, and students had the chance to choose whichever gallery was either most convenient to them or closest to them.
So students have the opportunity to see their work, you know, professionally on a wall with a label in the context with a lot of other students that are working as they are. And I mean, I think we all probably have that experience at our awards reception where a student brings their family and pulls them over to their work, and their family sees that work hanging there, and then they're able to talk about the class or the assignment, and it's just this really beautiful moment.
It's also like their first opportunity to show their work, and we keep that application pretty professional, so they're having to answer the questions that a professional artist would and provide us with images and dimensions and titles and things like that and an explanation about the work. I have actually a student who is showing at the Northview Gallery, and he's had a lot of struggles. Like, he has accommodations for learning disabilities, and he was so happy that the show was up, and he was like, two of my pieces got selected. I just didn't think that they were good enough. But I could see how he was so much more engaged in class today just because of that experience of being chosen for the show.
The students do learn a lot about, you know, how do you communicate your work to someone else. You have to think about photographing the work, titling it, as you were saying, you know, writing a little bit about it. So all those are things that, if they do decide to pursue art professionally, are super valuable to have an experience with.
So what's the current situation for funding the arts at PCC?
Well, I'm going to just be frank, speak from our perspective as gallery directors and the labor we put into the shows and the funding that we need to put into those shows. Even with the funding we're given now, it always feels like it's not enough. At least for the Paragon, a good majority of it goes to the artists. So kind of what Christine said, when we have our open call and we select our artists for the year, we reserve a certain amount of money for each artist. We have a small section of it as well for supplies, and another section of it goes to our assistants. It always feels like I wish I could give the artists more. And so for us right now, we are looking at our budgets potentially being cut. I feel like there's a really good chance that is going to happen just from the conversations we've been having. But it is certain that our release time is being cut. That's going to impact the quality and time we can put into our practice as directors. And that is such a shame, honestly. So a course release is, there's a set amount of courses that a full-time faculty teaches within the year. So as a gallery director, we get a release from the amount of classes that we teach in order to fulfill the position of being a gallery director.
I really feel what you're saying, Zainab, about wanting to pay our artists more. The artists who come to our campuses and engage with our students put so much time and effort, not only into their exhibitions, but then also into the mm-hmm. events and the programming. And we already, we struggle to try to pay what would be comparable to what other arts institutions can pay, but we just don't have a large enough budget to do so.
When I first started doing this, which is 7 years ago, I used to joke that this was a full-time job on top of my full-time job. Mm-hmm. But back then, I had 20 hours a week of an assistant, and I'm potentially looking at not having an assistant next year. And I really don't know how I can manage this mm-hmm. on my own.
Like, the burnout really does come from fighting for the things we need that are the bare minimum. That is where the really big fight comes in, where it's like, I have no problem spending hours with the artists to get this show up. It's exhausting, but it's exciting, and knowing the potential of it. But the exhausting part really is going through all of that red tape for the bare minimum.
It's a dream thing that we get to do. We're very lucky that we get to talk with students and artists in a gallery about art. Like, it's amazing. I would do it for free, but it's really impossible to imagine actually having the time to program the events, to work with the artists, to connect with classes, mm-hmm. to write the press release and try to reach out to the community beyond our college walls if we don't have time to do that. And that really is where the release time, being able to not teach a class, to have that time instead to do the gallery work, is extremely valuable.
We need to firmly state, too, we are a professional gallery. Each one of us runs a professional gallery. And for these cuts to come in, to me at least, feels like we're not able to be at the standard that we are currently at right now.
Well, it seems like the arts are constantly in danger of losing funding. In our current moment, what is the particular importance of funding the arts, especially on a community college campus?
We've just been seeing so many emails and Instagram posts from significant arts organizations in the city who lost their NEA grants, and it is heartbreaking. It's devastating. And so I think that, you know, in the context of PCC, if we can do one small thing in keeping these three galleries open, and then, you know, potentially finding ways to support and promote the other arts organizations in the city that are mm-hmm. that are, you know, struggling, we have to do it. I mean, we need artists, writers, performers, musicians more than ever now, because we are a community college. Many of our students with art in the art galleries right now are not art majors and they're not planning to pursue that field. But think about the power of introducing every single human who comes through our doors to the fact that they too have the potential to create, to make something with their own hands, to tell their story to anyone who enters the gallery and will listen. I think that's something that we don't want to give up on. Mm-hmm. And to me seems really important, particularly in this world where there's the potential of things coming in to take over our creative capabilities. You know, when I can push a button and AI will do it for me. I think it's really vital for us to provide these spaces where anyone can have access to their own creative power.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
The way that the letter was written, it was very arbitrary and unlawful overreach that basically threatened the education of all Maryland students.
Kenya Campbell with the American Federation of Teachers in Maryland is celebrating a federal court for blocking the Department of Education from withholding funds over diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. President Donald Trump argues DEI initiatives brainwash students and violate the Civil Rights Act. New York Head Start programs say they're caught between delayed federal funding and a Trump administration move to bar undocumented families from the program. Susan Stamler is with United Neighborhood Houses.
This is an amazing program that actually should be expanded, not limited, and should certainly not have any kind of citizenship test connected to it.
21 states have sued, warning compliance could force Head Start centers to close. Trump is threatening to deploy the National Guard in Chicago, citing high crime and illegal immigration. The mayor calls the idea unconstitutional and says violent crime is down more than 30% compared to last year. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker warns the move is a trial run for a police state. The new Texas congressional maps have passed the legislature but are being challenged in court as a racial gerrymander. Trump says they are, quote, a big win, although California Governor Gavin Newsom is signing a plan aimed to respond in kind. Former President Barack Obama endorses Newsom's, quote, measured approach in a moment of emergency. Arkansas's largest county is updating its voter rolls. Davita Hardin with the Pulaski County League of Women Voters says don't ignore the letter if you get one.
They can respond within 30 days to the county clerk's office. If they don't, then they will be classified as removable. They will be removed from the rolls at that point, and then they'll have to re-register.
Nevada's largest utility is asking for its third rate hike in 3 years. But Camelot Todd with the Nevada Conservation League says NV Energy is being forced to refund ratepayers because of billing errors, which they tried to hide.
They overcharged more than 80,000 customers by $17 million for more than 2 decades, and then tried to avoid full payment of those overcharges by applying the wrong refund rule.
Critics charge the just-released interview of Ghislaine Maxwell shows the convicted sex trafficker can't be trusted about who participated in late pedophile Jeffrey Epstein's crimes. Maxwell told a DOJ official she never saw anyone doing anything wrong. The family of Epstein victim Virginia Giuffre calls that laughable and accuses justice of giving Maxwell a chance to rewrite history and angle for a pardon from Trump. Details remain sparse on the FBI search of former Trump national security advisor John Bolton's home. Bolton, an Iraq war hawk and Trump critic, has faced past criticism over his handling of classified documents. The White House insists criminal charges are on the table and has said it would use the justice system to punish enemies. I'm Farah Siddiqui for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Up next, our weekly jazz calendar.
Hello, X-Ray listeners, and welcome again to Jazz in Portland. I'm Thomas Smith, here with Tom Skelly.
Hello, Thomas.
The Montevilla Jazz Festival, presented by the Portland Jazz Composers Ensemble, runs from August 29th through 31st. It has 28 events at 4 venues: Alberta Rose Theater, Mount Tabor Caldera Amphitheater, Portland Metro Arts, and the 1905. Check the website, montevillajazz.org. Here are some events for the week of August 25th. Monday, August 25th, at the Joe Bar and Rotisserie at Papa Haydn, 715 Northwest 23rd Avenue, Blue Note Mondays, Chris Wojtok and John Moak cover Jimmy Giuffre's Traveling Light, 7 to 10 p.m. Tuesday, August 26th, at the Goodfoot, 2845 Southeast Stark Street, Greater Kind Quartet, Jazz Fusion, 8 p.m. Wednesday, August 27th, at the 1905 830 North Shaver Street, just off Mississippi, Noah Simpson Quartet, 6:30 and 8:30 p.m. Thursday, August 28th, at Arrivederci, 17023 Southeast McLaughlin Boulevard, Ronstein Band featuring Cheryl Alex, Greg Goble, and Phil Baker, 7 to 9 p.m. Friday, August 29th, at Bridgeport Village, 7455 Southwest Bridgeport Road, in Tigard, Heather Lee Vindeman Jazz Group, 6 to 8 p.m. Saturday, August 30th, at Wilf's, 800 Northwest 6th Avenue at Union Station, Billy Edson and Friends, Vocals and Incredible Music, 7 to 9:30 p.m. Sunday, August 31st, at Joe Barn Rotisserie at Papa Haydn, Dimitri Matheny Trio, 7 to 10 p.m. Stay tuned for more info on jazz in Portland and streaming online everywhere at xray.fm. Thanks for listening. Enjoy Portland music.
That was your weekly jazz calendar. Up next, we've got some music coming to Portland. There's a few bands that I took note of. There's this interesting band called Earth out of Seattle, Washington, and they're going to be playing at Mississippi Studios on Tuesday, September 2nd. I'm just going to play a part of their song because this one is 11 minutes long. So, yeah, just a little taste of that. And then we'll be back for some more. This is called From the Zodiacal Light. Or is it zodiacal? Zodiacal, right? Zodiacal. Yeah. We'll be right back. Oh, you know what? Never mind. You know, sometimes your computer just has to restart. It just thinks, nope, not today. So we're going to move on to a song called... Well, we're going to move on to something. Oh, wow. Wow. Julia's like... a super fast lightning person with fingers of speed.
Here we go.
Okay.
Here's Earth, the zodiacal light. Let's go.
Thank you.
Once again, that was the band called Earth. They're going to be playing in town very soon. I believe it's Mississippi Studios tomorrow. This is a band called Ibu. This is their song, Sunder.